This is Radioactive Magazine, a KKFI public affairs program of progressive activism, opinion, and commentary. Opinions expressed on this program are those of the speakers alone and are not necessarily the views of KKFI, its staff, volunteers, board of directors, show hosts, or other guests on the program.
Fellow workers, the industrial workers of the world mean to organize the entire working class into one big union. What is the working class, fellow workers? Why, the working class is anyone who has a boss and makes wages. I don't care if you're a college professor or a ditch digger. If you got a boss and you make wages, you're a member of the working class, so be proud of it. Why, that middle class is just a joke told by the bosses to keep us fighting one another. Now, the industrial workers of the world mean to organize the entire working class into one big union, the OBU. All skilled, semi-skilled, and unskilled workers into one big union. Then we're going to call a general strike. A strike like that will last about 30 minutes. And then we're going to take this thing apart and put it back together so it makes more sense. Put the means of production into the hands of those who produce. Produce for use, not for profit. Abundance for workers, nothing for parasites.
That was the inimitable Bob Soukial, and that's an example of what a free speech fight would have sounded like when the industrial workers of the world had their free speech fights and spoke like that on the street corners. In fact, one right here in Kansas City in 1915. Well, the industrial workers of the world were first formed in Chicago in 1905, and a lot of people don't realize it, but the IWW is still around, and we're going to explore that tonight. We're going to interview some of the brothers and sisters with the local chapter of the industrial workers of the world, and then we're going to have an interview with Fred Lee, the late Fred Lee, who died just a few months after this, who spent his life actually working for social justice and social causes and as an active member of the IWW. So first, here we go with the interview by the industrial workers of the world Kansas City branch. Okay, we're here with a couple of members of the IWW branch from around the area here, and I'm going to have these two fellow workers introduce themselves.
Hello, I'm with the Greater Kansas City IWW GMB, and I work in the printing industry. I've been a member for about 2 years.
I'm in the service industry, and campaign at work isn't exactly public, so I'd rather not say where or who.
Why don't you tell us the story of how you happened to get involved with the IWW and what it was about the IWW that attracted you?
Well, I was taking Judy Ansel's labor history classes and immediately fell in love with the IWW and thought that was a nice relic from history, and later found out that it actually still exists but was afraid to join because it was a radical labor union. And I can't do anything radical, and I didn't know even what that meant. It just sounded really scary. And so I figured I would join a mainstream union and pay dues and be part of the union culture, and was rejected by the four unions that I approached about joining. And all the while I'm thinking, well, the IWW will let anybody join. So I finally joined it and figured, well, I'll be brave, and whatever radical means, I guess that's what I have to do to be in a union, and have been at it ever since.
Well, you mentioned that they let anybody join. I think that does at least harken back to the beginning of the IWW, where their mission was to organize the unorganized and to represent those that were not represented any other way and were not in craft unions, things like that. So you harken back to the very beginning. How about you, brother? A little bit of your story on why you joined the IWW and how long you've been a member and what got you there.
Well, I guess I was attracted to it because of the radicalism. I was interested in organizing at work, and so I emailed the headquarters, and they put me in contact with my fellow worker here, and the two of us, I live in Lawrence, she lives here in Kansas City, and the two of us put together the branch once we'd been put into contact with each other.
Give us an idea, how many people are in the local branch, and are they, are you guys from Lawrence or Kansas City or both, or kind of from the area or what?
We definitely cover the area. There are about 30 members between Kansas City, Lawrence, Wichita, and one in Joplin now as well.
How long has this branch been around?
It's been around since we actually got chartered in August of 2010, I believe. Well, I joined and I received a letter in the mail that says, "Welcome to the IWW. You are the union." Your closest contact is in Omaha. So I called up Omaha and said, what do I make, a Facebook page or something? And the people in Omaha said, yes, you are the union. You're empowered to build your own branch. This is membership driven, not a top-down structure. So yeah, go be it. And I got in contact with other members that had been members in the past and then found new members, and we did it.
You said that the radical part of it attracted you. Give me some ideas on what you mean by the radical part of the IWW. What do you find that's so radical about it?
Well, our mission is not just to improve working conditions, but to ultimately get organized enough to take over industry and fire the bosses. We're an anti-capitalist union. The bosses have been in charge of industry long enough, and we've seen them with the mess that they've made of it around the world. And we think it's time that the workers ought to have a shot at running industry and see if we can't do a better job.
Now, you say there's about 30 people in the branch. Give me an idea. What are those fellow workers? What kind of industries they come from? All over? Or kind of give us a flavor of what some of them do?
All different industries. We have several teachers, healthcare workers, musicians, fast food workers, or service industry workers broadly. Pretty much a little bit of a lot of things.
Okay. Now, of course, one of the organizing part of it, you've done very well of going from zero to 30 members in a couple of years. How about any other organizing? Have you had any worksite activities or any other kind of organizing activities you've done as a branch?
Currently, the campaigns we have going are not public, so I'm hesitant to give a lot of details for fear of revealing any organizing campaigns.
It's a part of our strategy is to do as much organizing as possible underground until we're ready to go public. We don't necessarily want the boss to know what we're up to until it's strategically right to do that. So yeah, at this point we're not there with any of our campaigns. They're all underground at this point.
We did recently have an action at one workplace, though. A fellow worker had quit his job and gone on to work somewhere that was less abusive, and his employer was withholding several weeks of pay.
$1,200, over $1,200 worth
at minimum wage, and we were able to recover that, and that would not have been recovered if we had not gotten involved.
Tell us a little bit about your general meetings.
Well, we have monthly general membership branch meetings, which is where we take care of all the business, how to allocate funds, and what sort of campaigns, how to support campaigns, and who to endorse and whatnot. And then we have, in both Kansas City and in Lawrence, we have weekly socials where we get together. It's very informal. And we just hang out, chat, sing labor songs.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the music, because after all, the IWW is known as the singing union, and there's a great history of IWW songs. And tell us a little bit about singing labor tunes, and you guys are getting together to do that, and how that came about, and how often you're doing that, and whatever you want to say about it.
Well, we have several talented people in our branch, string instruments and singers. We sing all the old tunes, Joe Hill, yeah, Solidarity Forever. it's a lot of fun, and it's a good way to make a presence in on the picket line or just raising funds downtown or whatever.
Well, in addition to the activities you do that for the IWW itself, does the branch support other things that are going on out there in the community as far as other political or economic actions are concerned, Occupy or any of those organizations?
Our branch did endorse Occupy KC, and we've also more recently been involved with the Walmart Workers Campaign. That's been a really big interest for a lot of IWWs locally and in general.
So do you sponsor any kind of trainings for your membership?
Yeah, we have a training program that's based off of a pretty solid history of organizing. It came out of the work that's been done with Jimmy John's and Starbucks that other branches have done, and they put together a pretty comprehensive training program. Since we've become a branch, we've hosted three of them. Yeah, it's a two-day program where people really learn the in and out and nuts and bolts of how to build solidarity in their workplace and use that solidarity to organize and fight.
Okay, before the interview, we were talking about a recent victory that the IWW had organizing. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
The broader union, aside from just the greater Kansas City area, has a lot of different campaigns going all over the country and all over the world. And one of the more recent wins was the Starbucks Workers Union, which is the IWW, won time and a half for all employees on Martin Luther King Day.
That's great, and I appreciate having these two fellow workers. If you want to say a few parting words and tell people how they can get involved if they want to come and find out more about the IWW branch.
Well, what we need is people who are willing to put work into their own workplace. You know, we've all got grievances with our boss, and so if you're interested in organizing around those grievances and you want to get the support and training that you'd need to do that, then you can contact us. You can get a hold of us through our website, which would be kciww.org.
Well, thank you both for being on KKFI with us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
In his book, The Wobblies, published in 1967, Patrick Renshaw points out that the height of the IWW membership was in the 19-teens and 20s, and by the late 20s, it was effectively a dead organization. Yet here we are, still talking about the Wobblies 108 years after its founding in 1905. Why should we still be talking about a union that was proclaimed effectively dead almost 100 years ago?
Well, that's a nice question to be introduced with. The issue of the IWW being at its height of its membership in 1918, 1917, early 1920s, is an interesting one. Of course, that particular quote by Patrick Renshaw does not indicate the fact that the U.S. government, with an entire legal and military and police system, effectively crushed the union in 1918 with mass arrest. So the fact that it peaked its membership in the early 1920s is perhaps understandable if the whole federal government was designed to crush the particular union. The IWW is, in fact, the only union that has been systematically attacked and crushed by the U.S. government. But that doesn't really get to Patrick's question or the issue of why to talk about a union whose revolutionary unionism has been passed by unions of most of the 20th century is a good question. Why should you talk about a union or think about a union whose objective is to replace capitalism with a socialist commonwealth? Most people would say that will never happen. And if it happens, it's going to happen far into the distant future. So why do you want to talk about such a union? Well, you have to remember what the IWW stood for and what it came out of. What it stands for is that ordinary working people take control over their own lives, both in terms of how they work, what they produce, and who gets what. And that there is not an elite, whether it be a business class or a political class, or both put together, making these decisions for the working class and treating the workers mostly or basically as children. Children to be guided, children to be told what to do and who to do it for, and be respectful of their elders. That is not the world that members of the IWW want to live in. So the point is to change the world, not to live within it. So this gets us back to the question, why do we want to study or look at such a union today? Well, Patrick Renshaw was written right in 1967. I'm not sure why he would write it in 1967. There was a lot of revolutionary potential at that time. But it's a good question for today because you would get many people today saying, well, the existing economic system is perfectly fine. Why not simply maintain the status quo? Well, the point of this perfect system is to, in a sense, make 90% or let's say 80% of the people in the United States work and contribute to the well-being of 20%, or you want to say 90% to 10%. Now, if that's what you want the economic system to do and you want to legitimize that kind of economic system, then the last thing you want is to talk about a union that is dedicated to overthrowing, replacing that system with a socialist commonwealth. So the kind of question that was asked by Patrick Renshaw, is in fact a question of why not maintain the status quo and let the elite control the lives and ruin the lives and destroy the lives of 90% or more of the rest of society. The IWW is in fact the only union in the United States who has as its motto the overthrow and replacement of capitalism. There are also various political parties who would have the same objective, but not as a trade union dedicated to organizing in the workplace in every place, every corner, every shop, every factory in the United States. IWW is the only one that does this, the only one that carries the message that it's necessary to organize on the job floor to replace, as a way to replace capitalism with a better world. This leads into some particular issues that people might raise about the union, the fact that it's small or ineffectual. Well, let us try to put some of this in context. Think of a trade union in 1910 that would admit women and blacks. Try to think of one. The only one you're going to come up with is the IWW. Now, of course, the CIO and other trade unions subsequently did do this. But it took the IWW to make this point. Sit-down strikes. Where do they come from? You think that the people in Detroit thought up sit-down strikes all by themselves? No, the IWW organized sit-down strikes in 1907 against General Electric. That's just a couple of points. Other aspects is that the IWW always saw its movement of organizing in the workplace always combined with a social movement. So it's simply just not organizing for better pay, but for more than better pay, for better working conditions, and it takes a community to do that. They express this kind of social movement qua organizing in the workplace in any number of ways, such as plays or music. And, of course, IWW is well known for its music, for its various songs. But the point is that it was simply more than just workers organizing on the job. They organized, more broadly speaking, and engage more people, more of the community, more of the households, more women, if there was male-dominated industries they were engaged in. The point is that this is how the IWW would become successful, and these were the ways that the CIO in the 1930s and 40s was successful. And in fact, any union that has had broad success in the United States has combined organizing on the job floor with a social movement. And on top of that, in addition to organizing the job floor and the social movement, the IWW engages in education. Well, that is teaching workers or getting workers to learn how to learn themselves, how to understand how capitalism works, how the bosses screw you. Now, this particular vision or aspect of the IWW has in fact been was widespread at the time. You had socialist colleges emerging at the same time. Can't say communist because it wasn't a term not widely used. But socialist colleges organized, whether they be on the East Coast or, in fact, probably, 75 miles from us in some small towns in Kansas had socialist colleges organized. The point is that education was seen as a significant aspect of how to understand the world about you and understand how the bosses screw the workers and why you need to change the system. The IWW makes this a very important part of their program, as well as subsequently the Socialist Party of America, the Communist Party, the CIO, and other trade unions. The unfortunate aspect about this is that over time, certainly in the post-1945 period with the advent of McCarthyism, that what trade unions taught was to how to accommodate to the bosses. In fact, you can find this out in the CIO leadership trainings that they actually carried out in the late 1930s. How to accommodate to the bosses. And unfortunately, that's the educational program of most trade unions today. In fact, I have a hard time thinking of ones that would do something different, but there could be ones out there. This is not to say that labor education programs, such as the one we have at University of Missouri, Kansas City, headed by Judy Ansel, who gives students a very wide range of ideas about how workers should be educated and what they should know, and they're not to accommodate themselves to the bosses. We're talking about actual trade unions carrying out their own educational activities to have their leadership accommodate to the bosses so they can make their membership accommodate to the bosses. The IWW has never accepted that particular kind of viewpoint. They have never accommodated themselves to the bosses. They've always educated their workers. And if you join a union, you would get a number of little pamphlets to read. One of them would be the general strike. How to carry out a general strike. The IWW does not beat around the bush. The eventual agenda is to set up a general strike, carry it out, and take over the means of production and institute a new society. So the IWW has always had this three-partite combination of organizing, social movement, song, etc., and education. They come together. Now, various members of the union have excelled in one of those areas, and they expect other members to excel in others. So you will get people within the union in the past or the present who are good in the area of song or social movements. Other ones are good in organizing on the job floor. And others, like me, just are good at teaching, education. This is a tripartite activity. All of them are equal, and the union tries to work with that. But, of course, if you're going to engage in this kind of unionizing, trying to organize the job floor, then, of course, the status quo, the state, will come after you. They'll come after you in a number of ways. 19-teens and 20s was one of them when they went after all radicals, just not members of the IWW, but effectively more or less really not so much crushed a union, but made it somewhat ineffective because most of their activities were generated to trying to get their members out of prison. What really did the union in wasn't necessarily the Red Scare of the 1920s, was that because of the extreme pressures, there wasn't a lot of growth or development within the union. Dynamism has somewhat declined a little bit. And when the CIO comes in the 1930s, which is a lot more exciting, a large number of IWW organizers, complete with their entire membership, went over to the CIO. And so in one sense, part of the CIO's dynamism of organizing in the 30s is a result of the IWW's long work of 20 years, 25 years, to preparing workers to be able to join such a dynamic union in the 1930s. Of course, in the 1940s, the CIO goes right-wing and gets rid of its communist-dominated unions, say, an agricultural implements industry, and replaces them with those who would not question the status quo. That's another story, but up until that occurred, the CIO was a very dynamic union. And it was dynamic because of former IWW organizers, Communist Party members who were organizers and worked very well to create unanimity and collectivism within various unions, job shops, and various factories. The people who really made the CIO run, these damn wobblies and radicals, were eliminated, kicked out under the Taft-Hartley Act of 1948. In fact, the IWW is in fact the only trade union to be put on the subversive list in the United States. Now, if we put the CIO on the subversive list in 1950, do you think we'd have the CIO today or the AFL-CIO? If we put any organization on a subversive list, in fact, I don't think there's a single organization that was on a subversive list, Attorney General subversive list in 1950, that's in existence today. Well, take that back. The U.S. Communist Party did actually survive this, but barely. But the point is that these kinds of activities contribute to the decline and ineffectiveness of the IWW. So by the late 1950s, early 1960s, the only members of the union were basically long-term members who would simply not bow to the hegemony of the ruling class. And they were reinvigorated by those 1960s weirdos who oppose the war, oppose segregation, oppose racism, oppose sexism. These people joined the union. These younger people revived the union, and the union now has, let's say, recovered a little bit. Its radicalism is still there. Its engagement with a broader range of socialists is still there. They still engage in education. They do everything that the union has always done. The difference is that when the IWW tried to organize, say, in 1907, 1910, 1920, many times they were organizing large factories or a industrial district such as a coal field or logging, which would mean in a particular area such as in the Northwest. These are very particular kinds of unions they would be trying to organize, and they were successful in some, not successful in others, but the point is that's what they would be organizing. Today, the unions, I mean, the areas in which the IWW organized are much smaller units. These are units which they have extremely high turnover, temporary workers, and which it's very difficult to generate large-scale solidarity, because these units which they want to organize between are many very small units, such as Starbucks. That would be an example, which today we've also tried to organize other kind of small retailers which have multiple small units. These become very difficult. These are areas in which turnover is very large. These are areas which the main unions today have no interest in, because these people don't make enough money to pay hefty fees or union dues. So the main unions don't want to go in there. It's very, very costly, very difficult to organize. The IWW goes into there, which means that clearly there's a high, non-success rate. But it doesn't mean that the IWW doesn't leave its mark, because many of the times you try to go in and organize one of these places, it may fail. What happens is that the people who become most interested in this stuff go off to other places. They help organize other jobs. They may join conventional unions. But the point is that the legacy of organizing and controlling your lives is in a sense, spread out in an ongoing fashion, even among these temporary workers, these small units. I should note that these small units you engage in, the people who work in there are probably in the bottom 20% or bottom 40% of income earners in the United States. We're talking about low wages. Now, some people say, well, the big unions, oh, it's too expensive. The IWW's position is that if these are not the people that you want to organize first, why in the hell would you ever have a trade union? These are the people who need it. Those who are making $80,000 a year, they can suffer a little bit until they organize themselves.
We want to thank our guests for being on tonight's show, and also honor the great Fred Lee, who was interviewed tonight. Tune in next week for our Radioactive Magazine, when our producer Mike Nichols will bring you Connecting for Good, Bridging the Digital Divide.